Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about U.S. space policy. Earlier this month, the Bush administration announced the first update of U.S. space policy in a decade. The last policy was formulated and put in place by the Clinton administration back in 1996. And there are some differences between that policy and the new policy that has just been announced. The main goal of space policy back in 1996, the one that came first, had to do with the enhancement of knowledge. Now, the emphasis has shifted, and in fact, in the new document, the first two stated goals have to do with national security. Particularly, this new document rejects any limitations on the right of the United States to operate in space. This morning, in this part of the show, we will be talking about this new space policy, and also about the militarization of space with Laura Grego. She is a staff scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is visiting here at the campus of the University of Illinois. She's here sponsored by the folks at the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. And we're pleased that she could be here with us and spend some time talking. Questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we keep the program moving along and get in as many different calls as possible. But anyone listening is welcome to join in the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
We appreciate it. I was almost a little bit surprised to hear that a new policy had been announced because it really didn't get a great deal of attention. As far as I know, there was no formal announcement. There was no press conference. There was nothing like that. Do you think it, in fact, is the case that the administration was kind of hoping nobody would notice?
Well, I think that's the case. I know that they know that there are people who are keeping their eyes out, but this administration has released a number of other pieces of space policy concerning, for example, the commercial space industry. And for those pieces of policy, they held a press conference and invited the press in to ask questions. For this, which is presumably the centerpiece of space policy, and it's the executive directive that directs the way that we do civil and military space, it was announced on a Friday, the Friday before Columbus Day weekend, at 4 o'clock, because I was watching out for it. So I think it was deliberately released at a time where maybe it wouldn't get so much attention in a manner that it wouldn't draw so much attention. So it took maybe about a week even for the major newspapers to take a look and realize maybe there was something to talk about. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's the case.
And it is, now if people do want to read it, it is available. It's online. There are places people can see it. And the declassified version, the version that you can see, runs to, I don't know, 6 or 7 pages. It's not particularly long, nor I think is it particularly detailed. What, though, seems to be important and I think concerns people has to do with this, the shift in focus of policy. There are some things that really haven't changed very much. But as far as you're concerned, is it significant that we've gone from saying mostly what space exploration, our activities in space were about was doing scientific research, from that being the most important thing, our number one goal, to now national security being the thing that we say, now we're saying this is what's most important?
Yes, that is a significant change, and I think it's the biggest significant change in the policies. In the Clinton space policy, the first goal of the national space programs was civil space exploration, and for the purpose of enhancing our knowledge of the universe. Civil space has been moved down the list. The first two, as you mentioned, are national security goals. Some of that reflects a big change in context, though, between 10 years and today. 10 years ago, we didn't rely on space nearly as much as we do today. And maybe not everyone out there realizes it, but every day when you swipe your credit card, for example, or you get a news feed that's, you know, broadcast from the field, when you use GPS, when you get a just-in-time shipment, all of those things depend on the the working of satellites and the effectiveness of those. The military is by far the same way, and in fact is even more dependent on satellites, and much more than they were 10 years ago. I think the military sees that as a big critical capability to operating the way that they do, and they recognize that that's important to, that those capabilities are important to protect, and that has been moved up in primacy. This administration, when it first came in back 6 years ago, one of the first things that they did about space, there, Donald Rumsfeld, before he took the Secretary of Defense position, was the chairman of a commission that looked at space and what we want to do with it, and it was, it had a lot of very strong recommendations for military space, putting weapons in space, aiming weapons towards space objects. He had a lot of ideas, and then he, of course, took the Secretary of Defense position, which is very influential. And so even from the early days, the Bush administration has been very interested in the military uses of space. So it's not a surprise to see this, but it is an indication of a sea change in the way the administration is looking at the way we use space.
Mm-hmm. There's something else here that I know your organization thinks is significant, and I'm sure other people would think it's significant, and that is a change in the way that the United States government is talking about the notion of sovereignty in space. Previously, and in the last document, as I understand it, what the administration said was, we don't think that any government can come along and say, we own space. No one could come along and say, the moon belongs to us and nobody else can go there. The new document, in a sense, that says the same thing. It says, we, the United States, reject the notion that some country can come along and claim space, except we also support the notion that nobody can tell us that we can't do it. So it's not exactly the United States is saying nobody can do it but us, except that it's also saying that we think that we can do that, and if somebody comes along and say they don't like it, we're going to say that's too bad. And what now exactly, what is the position as in terms of someone, the United States or any other government, saying we believe that we have some exclusive right to operate in space because we think we have interests there and we're going to defend those interests? That's essentially what the United States is saying.
Yeah. Well, you've certainly hit upon one of the big contradictions in the policy. I think that's puzzling to people like me who try to keep track of these things. There was a change in language and tone. In terms of the content, in the 1996 policy, we recognized these same rights, but instead of saying we recognize... In the 1996, we said we recognize the right of all sovereign nations to operate freely in space. And instead, we changed the language in this policy to say we recognize the right of the United States to operate freely in space. So that doesn't exclude the other countries specifically. It just changes the focus. And I think you point to the contradiction that it's very difficult to, especially in a medium like space, which has some special qualities, it's very difficult to guarantee those rights to yourself and not guarantee, and to deny them to others, and to do that in any kind of sustainable way. And I think actually that conflict, or that the idea of trying to stake a claim, have freedom of action, that where you claim something special for yourself and not for others. This is a fairly characteristic way of approaching things, I think, for this administration. But the attempt to try to do that has enough contradictions. I think that might have been part of the reason that this policy was released in the way it was. I think there may be an internal discussion about how are we going to really achieve our goals in space, and do we have to play well with others to do this? And I have this feeling, I have no inside information, but my feeling is that there are some people who recognize that's not consistent and that's an impossible way to achieve your goal. And there may be others who still have yet to be convinced that it's not possible for the U.S. to dominate space and you know, hold the keys. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe they didn't end up working out that disagreement in the end, just decided to release what they had.
Well, just to echo the phrase you just used, do you think that in fact that this administration, that is their position, that is they think that they should dominate space and hold the keys, and that is a significant departure from what had been the previous policy, the 1996 policy?
Well, yes, in some sense that's true. In the way that the phrase that is used to describe this concept is called space control. And that was present in both the 1996 document and the 2006 document. This idea that we want to be able to, and that it covers a lot of ground. Space control means that we want to be able to be sure that our assets are safe for us to use. And that if somebody's using something that we don't like, the ability to deny them. the right to use or the ability to use their own space assets. In the 1996 document, it gave sort of a plethora of tools to do that, and that included sort of coercion, the possibility of weapons, and arms control, diplomatic and legal means. In the 2006 document, the diplomatic and legal means are absent. Those are not listed as a tool for doing this kind of work. So that's significant in showing the attitude of this administration, and we've seen there's a reluctance to engage the rest of the world on creating rules of the road for how we behave in space. I think the rest of the world has been calling for that. I think you even see the commercial space industry calling for better oversight and better rules, and it's pretty unusual to see the commercial industry wanting more regulation, but they seem to want to do that too. And that's just... it's maybe not the characteristic approach of the people who are writing this policy, so they left that out.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest for anyone who has tuned in last little bit here. We're talking this morning with Dr. Laura Grego. She's a staff scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. She studies the implications of physics and technology for space security. She's a physicist by her training. She has a PhD in physics from the California Institute of Technology. Her work takes a look at some of the technical issues of space weapons, and there at her organization, Union of Concerned Scientists, they're interested in developing a policy to ensure the secure and equitable use of space. Before going to work at the Union of Concerned Scientists, she was a postdoctoral researcher at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics from 1999 until 2002. And as I mentioned, she's here visiting the campus, brought here by the folks at the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. And we're talking about space policy. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Over the last few decades, I guess going back to the Reagan administration, there has been sort of an up and down when it comes to what it is we're thinking about doing or actually doing in terms of military involvement in space. And from time to time, there have been programs, high profile, less profile. We've spent money, we've not spent money. We've spent more money, we've not spent money. So it sort of goes back and forth. It depends upon a lot upon who's in control of the White House. Starting with Mr. Reagan, where he talked about the idea that you could have a space-based system to prevent or to intercept intercontinental ballistic missiles that would carry nuclear warheads. And from there, we've looked at a lot of different sorts of things, and now we have a land-based, an earth-based system to do, arguably, to do the same thing. Do you think this administration now taking a stronger position or taking a stronger look at either more land-based missiles, land-based systems focused on space, or actually space-based systems, looking at wanting to put more money into this or doing more research or moving strongly into this area than had been the case at least during the time that Bill Clinton was president?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are a number of differences, and you just covered a wide range of topics. So certainly, although the national space policy under the Clinton years is remarkably similar to the current one, which means it's pretty vague and allows a wide range of activities, the way it was interpreted during the Clinton administration was really... directed by the basically everyone knew what the opinion was of the administration was. And for example, there was a system developed, what we call an anti-satellite weapon, meaning something that was aiming at a satellite to take away its capabilities, either permanently or temporarily. And the administration was pretty hostile to that idea, and Clinton used a line item veto to kill that out of the budget. So it's pretty clear that although there were things that were allowed, there were not things that were being pursued. Now, when you look at the budget currently, especially in military space, you see an increase. You don't see a huge amount of money. You don't see it like in the Star Wars days where it was kind of a free-for-all, where there was a lot of money to be had, a lot of money to be spent. Because I think we've gone through that, and you could hear the protests of physicists everywhere saying this isn't going to work. And they spent their time and their money, And that was a concept that was more or less discredited, although there's always still a little bit of interest, a little bit of toe still talking about space-based missile defense. Now, I think, you know, the concept of space-based missile defense is seriously flawed. It would be incredibly and enormously expensive, and I think in the current context, when we have so many other national security priorities, that's really unlikely to be funded at a level that would build a system. Besides the fact that it would be, perhaps, it would not be very useful. But what's happening is that there is money to build test assets. So instead of having to fight the concept of a huge sort of space-based missile defense concept, there's the attitude of, well, let's just test some stuff out. Let's see what we can do. You know, let's make a few. We'll put them up there. So any kind of, for example, and there's slated to be money in fiscal year 2008 for a space-based missile defense test bed. What that entails is not totally clear, but what it's likely to entail are a few space-based missile defense interceptors. Now, having a few interceptors doesn't do you any good protecting against missiles, because anyone who would want to launch a ballistic missile knows when those interceptors are in the right spot to intercept you, and they will just launch later at a different time. So there's very little capability for missile defense. However, the same kind of interceptors, those same test assets, would be very useful in attacking other satellites. So what they actually would look like to other countries who have space assets would be kind of a threat on their own satellites. And so there are these, and it's very hard to fight against testing and development, research testing and development in the budget, because people say, what's wrong with research? But these, just a few test assets actually can look like a big threat to other countries. And what that is sort of putting a toe across the line. There's been a taboo against attacking other satellites, and we haven't tested those kind of weapons for 20 years. And in the current climate, other countries, Russia and China, have been long calling for the U.S. to come and start talking about what are the rules for engagement, what are the rules for the road, how do we, how do we keep our satellites protected? And in that such an environment, for the U.S. to move ahead and have something like a space-based test bed that breaks a taboo, although it's not spending a lot of money, what it does is creates what we call facts on orbit. Which means
that's the corresponding term to facts on the ground.
Facts, exactly. Facts on orbit, which is we don't have a lot of money to spend. You guys are thinking about something else, but we're going to set the stage for a later for a later program. And there are a number of small programs that are like that. They are maybe not large scale. There's a lot of money going into basic technologies that would support space-based weapons and weapons aimed from the ground to space. And basically, most of the programs are small scale, and they're basically these sort of taboo-breaking things, research and testing. And I have my biggest opposition to that is that we were doing that without really considering what are the following consequences to that. It's not something you do carelessly, because there are a lot of consequences to that. So we keep a careful eye on the budget and try to always follow what's going on. So there are a few projects like that. So it's, again, so the problem isn't huge amounts of money right now. Now, the other concepts that are included in this policy that have to do with space weapons or what we call anti-satellite weapons, which are either on the ground or in space, but those are things that would hold a satellite at risk. In this suite, there's space-based missile defense, which we just talked about. There is something called prompt global strike, which is this idea of having satellites in space that can attack a ground target on demand very quickly, sort of on order of an hour, with precision, with some kind of good precision. I don't see very much interest in that. It's one of the things that alarm people the most when you hear that idea, that something could kind of, one of the concepts for that is something called rods from God, and they would be big titanium rods that would be dropped from a satellite and would hit a target on the ground. The concept is very difficult. When you think about what kind of targets would those be useful for? And I think that I don't see very much interest for that, and I don't see a lot of money in the budget. So although it's something that sounds particularly alarming, I don't think that that's the focus of the administration. But where I think the focus is controlling space and controlling who has access to space assets and who doesn't. because satellites are so valuable to our economy and the way that into the military, into civil life, and other countries certainly have assets too, and they recognize how important they are, and they may even recognize that that's important in the future for them, for military systems. The U.S. is thinking about how do we keep these capabilities for ourselves, and when we want to, how do we deny them to our adversaries? And I think that that's the core issue that they're grappling with. How do we do that? And I don't think that, in my opinion, I think this approach, which is let's develop anti-satellite weapons as one of our tools, I think that there's a lot of problems with that and a lot of flaws. And in the end, makes the U.S. satellites much higher risk. We lose something. We lose confidence in our satellites, and we might lose our satellites.
Let me just, I have a caller here I want to get to. Just sort of to underline one point, I think that probably in a lot of people's minds, when you talk about militarization of space, the thing they think about is ballistic missile defense, just because that's something that we actually have been working on, and there's been a lot written about it. And that it seems that they're not, whether you're talking about space-based or earth-based, you're talking about systems that cost a lot of money to develop, and then there are significant technical challenges to actually make them work. It sounds as if, though, that this what you're talking about here, particularly space-based anti-satellite weapons, they're something to be concerned about, as you say, because of our reliance on satellites for both military purposes and commercial purposes. But from the and you correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds as if the technical challenges are not as significant there. Knocking out a satellite would be a lot easier than knocking out an incoming ballistic missile.
David, you're absolutely right. You've hit upon one of the really important points about this. Satellites are really vulnerable in this way. Satellites go overhead. I was watching a TV show the other day. It's the first time I watched 24 that everyone watches. Okay. And this character said, I really need reconnaissance over this Beijing embassy. Can you move the satellite over? Okay. And that's artistic license, because that's not how satellites work. Satellites move overhead. Satellites in low Earth orbits, which are the ones that look at the ground, they go around the Earth in 90 minutes. So they move fast. And by virtue of moving fast and the Earth moves underneath them, they go over almost every country during the day. So it's not as if you've dug in your asset at home and you can build a bunker around it, you're going to protect it. These satellites go over, our enemies, if we have them, and our allies. So they're in that sense that they're always out there. You know where they are. These orbits are predictable and calculable. So anybody with an undergraduate physics degree, or even not, there are plenty of people who don't, can time and know where a satellite is going to be ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So they're repeatable, they're predictable, and they're not very well protected, because launching a satellite is very expensive, and you don't put extra weight on if you don't have it. So you don't put a shield of armor around them. So they're difficult to protect. They're basically a very vulnerable but very valuable asset. And that is really, I think, what the critical problem is. They're so valuable that that they sort of invite, they may invite somebody interfering with them. Now, yet we don't see that very much. I mean, it's interesting, although they're so valuable, you see some kinds of interference with their communication functions. But we haven't seen a lot of purposeful interference yet. But this is...
And there's nothing in the way of an international convention about anti-satellite weapons. There's nothing out there that there's no sort of structure for nations getting together to talk about what we will do, or what we think we shouldn't do.
Well, that's right. There's the major piece of law that covers actions in space is called the Outer Space Treaty. That was almost 40 years ago now. The anniversary will be next August, And the piece that most people think about, the Outer Space Treaty, the big thing that it does is it outlaws weapons of mass destruction in space and stationing any weapons on the moon or other space bodies. But it doesn't address any other kinds of weapons specifically. But it does go on really in detail about how space is the province of all humankind, and its benefits should be divided equitably, and that no country should interfere with any other country's peaceful use of space and space assets. So it sets the stage for that. This is the way we're supposed to be doing things. Everyone can use it. It's nobody's, and we should let everybody do what they're going to do and not interfere. So that's supposedly the tone. Now, but there's no specific law that says if you do this to my satellite, that's against the law. There is something called the Liability Convention that says if you've done something that interferes with my satellite, like let's say yours broke up, your satellite broke up, you lost control and it ran into mine, the country that the satellite was of origin is responsible for reimbursing me for that. So that's, but these laws are fairly weak. And I think everyone recognizes that I feel very strongly that we don't have a set of norms and customs that govern this kind of activity. For example, in a crisis, a country might say, well, you know what, I want to get this country's attention, or perhaps I would like to get the U.S.'s attention. I think interfering with the satellite, we didn't lose any life. We think this is a minor way of escalating a conflict. That's no guarantee that the United States would view it in the same way, because if you look at, for example, war games, which is a way that military planners try to figure out what the possibilities of different things happening are. In war games, you see that when a satellite, especially a reconnaissance satellite, that's meant to allow the commanders to see what's happening on the field and to plan their battles and to assess damage, when those satellites are interfered with, things escalate really, really quickly. Much more than I think anyone had expected. They say, if I can't see what's happening, I'm just going to hit them with everything I have. So there's this, what can happen is that you create these increases in instability and these scenarios that have outsized outcomes. When we have no customs, no laws, no discussion about, you know, what are our customs and what do we believe? There's no rules of engagement yet. And I think that's a real lack.
We're at our midpoint here, a little bit past. I have a caller who's been patient, and we'll get right to them. Let me introduce again our guest, Dr. Laura Grego. She's a staff scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's a physicist by her training. She has a PhD in physics from California Institute of Technology and studies the implications of physics and technology for space security. If you're interested in finding out more about the Union of Concerned Scientists, they do indeed have a website. There's a lot of information there about the organization, and I'm sure also you will find information about this particular issue and others. We have a caller here, and others would be welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller is in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to campus. I cited your website recently, UCS, for the flash illustration of what the best possible nuclear bomb against Iran to take out subterranean supposed nuclear developments. I think it's worthy of looking at again. I think they predicted lots of deaths all through, even into the Indian subcontinent. So I think you guys do some great work. I wanted to ask you about Vision 2020 and Vision 2025. These are documents from the Air Force, and I think they are warrant as much discussion as the executive branch. And since you're going to ACTUS, you probably have a lot of I think you would have at least a few Air Force people there, and they're probably familiar with. I think the Vision 2020 is absolutely embarrassing because it's so frank. It's also illustrated by some of the most garish graphics you can imagine in the heyday of, you know, declaring full spectrum dominance. Now, it was during the Clinton administration that was released. So I haven't looked at Vision 2020, which is the updating of this document. I assume that they've used another different color scheme. But I also wanted to point out Rods from Gods, which you mentioned in passing, is a direct militarization attack from above to the ground. It's not an anti-satellite. So all of that's being fantasized. There's an early work called Arming the Heavens that goes through the 50s and the 60s and looks at the absolute incredible notions that were held in the Pentagon and other areas for what space was going to do for militarism. There's even the argument by the same author who says that the space shuttle was upsized to make it sort of a rapid deployment force, which is pretty bizarre anyway. But that's why we were stuck with this larger device, which makes it inherently more dangerous. But anyway, I'd like to read his brand about specifically the military's, and are you looking at those documents too?
Wow. Well, thank you for the welcome, and thank you for taking a look at our work. And that's an interesting question. I've definitely looked at those documents. In fact, I was for a long time really hoping to see the National Space Policy come out because it was the review was recommended in 2002. And basically in that time, what we had were these lower level planning documents like the Vision 2020 that you mentioned. And they're fantastical. You know, it was like, it was a wish list of everything you might possibly ever want if you had unlimited money and unlimited cooperation from the rest of the world. And I mean, even looking at them, there's some things that aren't even really physically possible. So in a sense, they're not a serious planning document, and they were not directives from the executive branch. But that was what other countries had to go on and what they could look at. And it's difficult in this country to parse what does Vision 2020 mean and who, you know, how does that direct where the money goes and what actually happens? It's hard, you know, even if you speak English and you are sort of associated with Washington, for me, it's hard to figure out where all of those things fit together. But from outside the country, it's nearly impossible. And so these documents generated huge reactions. It's funny that when I talk to colleagues and or just regular people in other countries, how much more they know about the U.S. military space program than most Americans do, because they've been reacting to these really provocative documents. And I think that was really unfortunate, because we didn't have a top-down executive-level policy saying this is what we are really interested in and this is what we're not. And so we've been wanting that for a long time. I was really hoping to see a strong, thoughtful vision on those things. And I don't think that the National Space Policy is that. So I've looked at those, and I'm not sure how. In fact, I'm not sure how serious to take those things. I think in the end, what we do is try to, as you say, follow the money, and see what's really being funded and what's really got support behind it. Because a lot of those things that are illustrated in vivid detail, I think just are never going to be anywhere in the realm of possibility. That's my feeling, and that's my hope.
I don't know. You're speaking out. I've heard you on a couple of chat shows. I think, as you point out, very little of this discussion happens in this country. And as the Vision 25 and Vision 2020 the Vision 2020, I mean, talked about economic domination of the world as one of the goals. I think it's important for us to treat this. And recently there was a book suggestion, which was Hegemony or Survival. Chomsky takes this quite seriously and has some extension discussion on it. I commend that to people's attention, too. Thanks. I hope you have a good visit.
Thank you for the call. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome to call with questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have been talking a little bit about what is now in this update that has been just released. It's been out a couple of weeks by the Administration of Space Policy. And it's a public document. It's unclassified. It's out there. Anybody can look at it, which makes me wonder, however, is there a classified version of this?
Yes.
Is there one, in fact, that might say other sorts of things that nobody knows about, or I can't read, you can't read, that would go further in some of these areas?
Absolutely. This is, and I'm not even sure that the administration is legally required to release an unclassified version, but they have, as far as I know, every time they release a new national space policy. So this is the unclassified version of the classified policy. Mm-hmm. And I haven't even heard rumors about what's in there that might be different. But I assume there's a large pot of money that is not in that is, I believe, dedicated to military space that is not unclassified. So I'm sure that there are activities happening that we don't really know about. And so that's, in a sense, how we operate. What we try to do is figure out at least what are the physics limits on what you can do, and to try to figure out what is most likely, what is most useful of the things that we don't know are happening. What are the things that we think might be happening, and what do we have to watch out for? And the thing about space is very interesting is that, as I mentioned before, you can see space from the ground. And it's pretty hard to hide your intentions and your activities there. So although there might be things in development, eventually most of that stuff, you're going to be able to see it. You're not going to have a secret weapon that you're going to pull out at the last minute. You might, but there's that's one advantage in space is that eventually your intentions are known mm-hmm. and seen. So,
and do you? How much money is dedicated to this kind of research?
To the unclassified budget.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know the classified budget. It's a few hundreds of millions, depending on how you split those things in research and development and what you include and what you don't, because there's some basic research and that's not including, you know, the big national missile defense kind of expenditures. Mm-hmm. So that's just the space-based. And there's been tons of reorganization in the budget, you know, for the, you know, I've been trying to follow the budget and every year they move things around. And I'm not sure if it's, I don't think it's actually purposefully obscuring things. I think it's just this incredible bureaucratic mess and they're trying to figure out what their priorities are. So it's, you know, in the scale of military budgets, it's not, that's not where you're going to argue. You're not going to, it's a lot of money. Anyone would want, you know, better resource management, but that's not going to be the big driver against these kind of things. It's not a huge amount of money. Mm.
And as far as classified spending is concerned, it's classified to the extent that not only do you not know what they're spending it on, you don't even know how much they're spending.
No,
the dollar amount is actually classified.
Well, there's some estimates of it, and I don't know. I don't have them in the top of my head. It's comparable and probably much more than the unclassified budget. Mm. So.
I wonder if have you been following the development of the land-based anti-missile?
I know something system. About that. My colleagues work on that more specifically, but I know something about that.
Well, I guess I was just wondering where things stand with that. This is something that that had been discussed for a long time.
Yeah.
Research had been done, and I think that you know, some number of scientists at the very least said, technically, this is extremely difficult. I don't know how many scientists would actually come out and say it's impossible, but I think there are a lot of scientists who would say this: what you're talking about doing here is really hard.
Well, yes. Well, here are the challenges. This is when we're talking about ground-based approaches to defending against ballistic missiles. And so just to review, the status of the program is that there are some, I think maybe 10 interceptors in silos in California and Alaska. So it's not totally clear what their status is, you know, of deployment, but they're there. The system has has not gone through a rigorous test system that approximates any real life conditions. They had a lot of failures and they've just started having better luck with their tests. So it's not a system that's ready to use. In a sense, you know, they often say, people often say, well, isn't some missile defense better than none? And you can imagine there's some truth to that, but what you really need is confidence in your system, right? Because if you're conducting foreign policy as if you were defended from ballistic missiles, but you're not, that's a serious problem. You really need to know how well can you defend against missiles. Now, one of the big technical problems with this kind of missile defense, what it tries to do is intercept the warhead after it's, so there are stages in a ballistic missile's launch. There's this launch phase right when it leaves. It's a few minutes long. It's a big rocket plume, and then it releases its warhead, and that travels through space. You know, that's the intercontinental part. It travels for a long time, and that's the point where the ground-based mid-course missile defense system is meant to intercept the warheads. Now, one of the big problems with that is what they call countermeasures, and that is if the person who launched the missile wanted to put some decoys in there. And the reason you'd put decoys is that they're very hard to discriminate from the real warhead, so you'd have to use one of your interceptors to intercept every one of those decoys. And they're much, much cheaper than interceptors are. So the attacker always has this advantage of throwing a bunch of junk up there that you have to go chasing after, and you might miss the real warhead. And critics of this, I often hear this, they say, well, you're just assuming that, you know, North Korea has all these technical capabilities that, you know, and that we have none. And that's not true in the sense of countermeasures problem. These countermeasures don't have to be very sophisticated because it's so hard to discriminate in space from one to the other. We've had a really hard time doing that, and they can be cheap balloons and things. So going into mid-course missile defense intercepting is difficult just from a physics standpoint. As a technical standpoint, they're still working out, you know, other kinks, but that's someplace they're going to come up against that limit and really need to work it through. So that's one reason that people keep suggesting space-based missile defense as a solution to that, because Well, really what they're looking at is boost phase, which means we're going to attack the missile as it's launching, before it releases the warhead and all the decoys. There's just one single thing we have to get. And you know what's so great about that is it's launching and it's so bright because it's, you know, it's a burning rocket. So it's a bright single target. And so we think boost phase, that's the way to solve this problem. And one of the biggest issues with that is that the boost phase doesn't last very long. So within just a few minutes, you have to see that it's starting to launch, find it, get your interceptor in place, and launch it and hit the missile in a very short time frame. So if you're a country that is surrounded by water, like maybe a country like North Korea, some people suggest you could do that from ships, you know, in the water. But for a country that keeps its missiles on the interior, like a country like the U.S. or China or Russia, there's no we don't have any borders where we could leave these interceptors close by. So there's a suggestion that, well, the way to address that is to go to space, and we'll put missile defense interceptors that'll be hovering over those positions. So anytime we see this missile launching, we can shoot it down. And that sounds like a good idea in that 30-second description. The big technical problems with that kind of thing is that in space, when you say, is some defense better than no defense, it's actually not true. Because satellites are so predictable, you know where they are. You can predict that. So there are two problems. One is that, so anytime you don't have a missile defense interceptor in place, your adversary will know it, and that's when they could launch. And the second problem is that satellites move very quickly, as I mentioned. And so to have one in the right place at the right time, at all times, would require, you know, for boost phase missile defense, thousands of interceptors, which is hugely expensive. And if you have, you know, 1,000 minus one, there's always one opportunity for someone to shoot at you. So there's this sort of very imperfect defense. So a little missile defense isn't any better than no missile defense in that case. So it's a very interesting conundrum. And when you going back to the ground-based mid-course missile defense, one interesting point that I would bring up is that they put all of their command and control communications through ground-based fiber optic cables. They decided that they didn't want their communications going through satellites because satellites might become vulnerable in the future, maybe because of our own actions, so that they were not going to count on satellites to be a critical link in the command and control of missile defense.
We only have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less. Our guest is Dr. Laura Grego. She's a staff scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we're talking about space and the militarization of space. We have a caller here who would like to get in on the conversation. Farina, I believe, Illinois, line 4.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
Could you, first a comment and then a question. This administration has obviously put forward a strategy of preemptive war and makes the world more dangerous. How does anybody in the world know that they don't just have orbiting nuclear weapons already and are, if not, are planning them? Could you talk some about the, I think it was the 1956 UN treaty banning nuclear weapons in space? Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for the question. I think you might be referring to the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, because that is one that bans weapons of mass destruction in space. And you're right to say, how do you know that no one has one up there right now? Well, there are some ways you can know, because almost every satellite up there has a stated purpose, and when you take a look at it, you can tell pretty well what it's meant to be doing. But the other reason that I would be very surprised to find any nuclear weapon in space is that if you were going to use a nuclear weapon in space, it's indiscriminate. It would not only take out your enemy satellites, it would take out your own. So you would be giving up your own satellites to the purpose of interfering with somebody else's, because basically, in low Earth orbits, if you detonate a nuclear weapon, you would probably destroy every satellite within the line of sight. And the ones that are not in the line of sight of that weapon would have to exist in this really highly highly electrically charged, a much more higher radiation environment than it's built for, and over the next few months would probably fail. So your own satellites would be held at risk. So it's hard to imagine who would be interested in doing that. It would have to be a country that didn't have any other satellites and didn't have any aspirations to use any anytime soon. And I don't think that there is anyone who would do that. And plus, using a nuclear weapon, detonating a nuclear weapon is so provocative that you would only use it for a really specific purpose. And I don't think, I have a hard time finding a scenario in my head where someone would actually do that.
And I suppose, I don't know if the caller was thinking about also the possibility of a space-based weapon whose target would be the Earth.
Yeah.
Now, although it seems to me that that's so... It seems to me that there are a lot easier ways to do it in, and rather than,
well, that's what ballistic missiles are for.
That's what ballistic missiles are for. What's the point of going to trouble to put up? There's no reason to do that.
No.
All right, let's talk with someone here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I don't see the rationale for a missile defense system, because if a country launches a missile, you know which country it is. Whereas they would probably take the alternatives, launch from a boat nearby, or detonate a dirty bomb, a radiological bomb, or pass it through our porous borders, the same borders that lets tens of millions of dollars of drugs through. It's so fluid there that they could use the same channels to infiltrate it with several dirty bombs. So what is your comment?
I think that's very insightful. It's a question of priorities. What are you going to spend money? What's going to make us most safe? What are the threats that are most likely, and what are the things that we can defend against? And I think I would agree that one of the least likely methods of attack of the United States is a nuclear weapon via ballistic missile. There are a lot of other ways a clever adversary could hold the U.S. at risk. And those are things that we really need to be working on. So I'd agree that our attention and money are better spent combating, keeping fissile materials safe, safeguarded, keeping the nuclear technology within bounds, stopping the black market in those technologies, and the spread of ballistic missile technology even is important. So I agree with you.
What have they spent on the missile defense system so far? Probably $10-20 billion.
I think that's $10-20 billion a year is the budget missile defense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an enormous amount of money, especially if you. I don't know the money. I don't know the amount from back from the 80s, but it's a lot. It's a lot of money.
Uh-huh. Well, thanks for your comment.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We're almost to the point where we have to finish. I mean, I guess I just want to review the what seems to be your main concern, that it looks as if the administration is interested in putting some money into doing some kind of research that might indeed lead to something being put in space under the heading of research that would be ostensibly something that would be focused at the ground, either offensively or defensively, but more realistically could be used as an anti-satellite weapon. Yeah. And there's some possibility of saying, well, we're not really quite sure how we're going to work this out, but let's do some research, let's do some testing. That you're concerned that there actually is a reasonable chance that some physical object might actually end up being placed in space sometime within the next few years as part of this?
Yeah, I have two concerns. That is the case, that I think that they're moving ahead with actually putting things in space. There have been a number of small-scale projects that sometimes have something tacked on to them. It's for a different purpose. There's a system called the Near-Field Infrared Experiment. We call it MFIRE. And it was meant to look at missile plumes to gather data for ballistic missile defense. And someone had the bright idea that maybe we'll put this sensor on a missile defense interceptor and shoot it close to that launching missile to take a good look at it. And while we're at it might actually run into that missile. So all of a sudden you've created a missile defense test where there is no oversight, no vetting of it. It just seemed like maybe something we could do. There are a number of little projects that take these little steps. And my biggest concern is this space-based missile defense test bed that's slated to start getting money next year. My big concern about anti-satellite weapons, when you look at space assets, there are over 800 satellites in space, and the U.S. owns over half of those. So we have the biggest investment. And yet we're thinking that one approach to solve our vulnerability in satellites is to be able to attack other people's satellites who don't have nearly as many. So what we're doing is introducing a weapon into this area where we have the most to lose and everyone else has the least to lose. And certainly if the U.S. crosses this line, it invites anyone else to that legitimizes satellites as targets, and any other country would be invited to do the same. And it really puzzles me that we're inviting this fight where we have certainly the most to lose without really exploring these other options of fixing the security problem.
Well, there we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Laura Grego, Dr. Laura Grego. She's a staff scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And she's here visiting the campus. As I mentioned, her visit here sponsored by the folks in the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. If you're interested in the Union of Concerned Scientists and the issues that interest them, you can go to their website. They're based in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Here.